the evening, Russell.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Russell.
I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great privilege to be here. It's always good for me to be at an AA meeting. It's a privilege when anybody asks you to share at an AA meeting. And I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, nor have I taken a drink, since January 25th, 1981. And so it's been a little while. You know, it's a record, not a record around here, but it's a record for me. So it's good to be here. So I'm trying to wonder. I'm wondering now why I called you all here together. There must have been a reason. I was up here. Presumably, we're on the eighth step. We'll see how that works out. I'll probably talk a little bit about that deal. I was up here. This weekend, I'm 65 years old. I got four kids, married 33 years. Yeah, sober 33 years, married 33 years. My sponsor told me, he said, don't make any major moves on your first year. So I picked up a 9-day chip and I got married. So didn't seem like a big deal to me, you know. Probably a really good thing that it happened that way. But so my wife is in Al-Anon. She's actually a... she's a mucky muck in Alamont. She's like the queen or something, or the princess, or she's like a lady in waiting. Or I think she's in charge of the voodoo dolls, you know, the whatever they use. Our ladies of perpetual revenge. And now men are allowed there. You know, I've been to these functions. Men are, you know, there are probably some guys in here that are also two hatters in Alamont. But you know, I've been to the meetings. There's like maybe three guys. You know. And who knows about them, you know, they're there, you know, and but it's a gal thing, you know, mostly. So my wife goes up, she has these quarterly deals. She's like very involved in it, and she has these quarterly deals where she goes up there usually with girlfriends, but, you know, every once in a while she sort of demands, I have like a demand performance. I have to, she may be one of her girlfriends like this, so I have to go up. It's up here at the, it's off of Cypress Creek Boulevard. There's like a Marriott North there, and that's where they have their district, whatever, the conclaves, you know. And so she suggests that it's important that I come up there with her, because I am in Al-Anon. So for you people who are not in Al-Anon, Al-Anon deals with codependency, you know. And, you know, I'll tell you, it's been my experience. I've been around for a long time that, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you probably have a little of that codependency bug, too. That's probably a big deal. Bill Wilson said, the next frontier is emotional sobriety. He said our real problems are unhealthy dependencies. Unhealthy dependencies. I mean, I guess that's dependent upon either unhealthy people, places, or things, or dependent on maybe healthy people in an unhealthy way. I don't know. And I've been trying to work this thing out. But I go up there to the deal, and she's a paratrooper in Al-Anon. I mean, she knows how to do an Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it. You know, the Al-Anon handshake, you know. And so here's the deal. So for you guys who don't know anything about Al-Anon, now let me tell you something. These are very strange people. These are very strange people. There's millions of them. There's millions of them all over the planet. I mean, really, you know, and they go to meetings for the rest of their life. You know, once you're in like forever. It's like a chronic disease. It's incurable. You know what I mean? It's like it's worse than alcohol, because you got, you know, they don't even get to drink and get here. You know what I mean? They're just like here. And it's like one day they're well and the next day kablooey, you know what I mean? And the bottom line is, apparently they catch it if they come in contact with us. It's like Ebola, you know what I mean? It's like they could be like in an elevator and they say two words, because there's something about an alcoholic, like we're so toxic. We you know, it's like they'll meet us and we'll have all these unbelievable problems and difficulties, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they feel that they have to fix us. And you know, and they feel that somehow they're responsible. As a matter of fact, if they don't fix us, they feel guilty. They feel bad. I mean, I don't understand the deal, but apparently that's what the deal is. So I go up there. I'm what's referred to in Al-Anon parlance, I would be referred to as her qualifier. I'm her. That's, we don't have that. I'm her qualifier. You know what I mean? Like booze was my qualifier. So I'm like her qualifier. You know, she gets together in these little, you know, these little. They got three or four of them. They're meeting there in a corner, and I'll see her sort of point to me, and they all sort of laugh. You know, and that's the guy. You know, and she tells me. So apparently, she was well before she met me. You know, and that's the deal. And so I was up here, and I got to go to So what happens is, you know, I'm up there and with them, and they're, you know who they are, right? They're the reason we're in here. But in any event, I'm up there with them, and I get to go to, and I have like a little meeting I go to escape. It's like, you know, a field hospital. It's a, I think it's called the Pembroke Pines. I'm not sure what it's called, Pembroke Pines Group or something like that. They have a 7:30 meeting in the morning and a 9 o'clock meeting. So when I'm up there, that's where I go. And I, so I went there. I got there at like 7:30 in the morning, you know, to, you know, get a little AA relief. And I apparently I came there. The meeting was just ending. And I came there when they were giving out the chips, and one guy gave out, and they gave out they had a 60-day medallion. I don't think you guys have a 60-day, but they had a 60-day medallion, and some guy picked up the 60-day medallion, and I felt, all of a sudden, I felt this wave of sort of nostalgia. And I've been around for a while, you know, 33 years, and I felt this wave of nostalgia where I felt... Well, you know what nostalgia is. I felt like I missed when I had 60 days. You know what I mean? God does a wonderful thing with us. All I remember is how good it was. I don't remember the horror story. I don't remember. You know, we have this saying, and I talk about it. It says, our worst day. What is this? An AA saying? We have all sorts of sayings in AA. Our worst, incredible sayings. Somehow they're helpful. At one point in our sobriety, they're helpful, you understand? At another point, they could be harmful, you know? I mean, for instance, we got this great saying, what is it? Take what you like and leave the rest. Take what you like and leave the rest, you know? You know, you just do the stuff you like and leave the rest, you know? Which is sort of good for a newcomer, you know? You say, well, yeah, I hate this God thing. And you say, well, take what you like and leave the rest, you know? The problem is when you're 15 years sober and you're a thumb-sucking crybaby, and you're hanging in there, and you're not being rocking the floor, and you don't understand why. It's because you've been taking what you like, and you've been leaving the rest, and the rest is the shit that makes you grow up and helps you, you know, on that sixth step that separates the men from the boys. The tough stuff, the stuff you have to do that really goes against the grain, that requires more willingness and more surrender, the tough stuff is the stuff that really will keep you sober for 30, 40 years and help turn you into something that's more than just a guy who's just not drinking. Change into a man or a woman and that kind of deal. So sometimes that stuff is good, and sometimes that stuff, if you latch on, because I'll tell you, I can't stay sober at 33 years based upon the stuff I was doing, the stuff I was thinking when I had 5 years. Nothing wrong with what I was doing when I had 5 years, but you know, I have to grow. I have to keep on moving, like one of those deals. So in any event, but we have another saying that says, our worst day sober is better than our best day drunk. I've been around for 33 years. That's not necessarily the case. Listen, if you think fear is bad when you're drinking, man, I'll tell you, I can't wait till you experience terror when you're sober. I can't wait till you experience that 3 o'clock in the morning stuff when they're foreclosing on your house and you got three kids and you got 50 bucks in the bank and you don't know where you're going to get any more money and you don't know where you're going to live. And you're sober and you know you can't drink, but suicide is looking pretty good. And I can't wait till you experience that old cancer stuff or all that other stuff, because you know something? Everything that happens out there to all of them, everything that happens to the drunks and all of them, the people who are drinking, not, you know, they're going to happen to us. You know, not drinking doesn't protect you from a lot of this stuff, from being fired, from having a crappy boss, from being treated unfairly, from all the stuff. It doesn't protect you from that. It protects you from some of the drinking stuff. I mean, if you don't drink, you tend not to get arrested for DUI. But, you know, so a lot of the drinking stuff, a lot of the consequences of my drinking and what happened when I was drinking, like, went away. But, you know, it says, there's a line in A we use, it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism. Alcoholism, I'm not talking about alcohol drinking. I'm talking about alcoholism because I learned, you know, I came here because my life turned into a bottle. You know, if you're an alcoholic, I didn't come here because I had a, you know, because of relationships or I needed a gal or I needed money. I came here because I couldn't stop drinking. I got to the point where I was drinking against my will. I would imagine there's some people in here that woke up one morning and said to themselves they weren't going to drink anymore, and all of a sudden they found themselves drinking anyway. I mean, if you ever get to the point in your life where you can't envision life, you can't envision continuing to drink, but you can't envision stopping drinking. If you get to the point in your life where you just can't stop, you don't. That's what I told the guy. I didn't even have to go to a meeting. I looked the guy in the eye and said, I can't stop drinking. That was my line. You know, I didn't say I'm powerless over life. Alcohol in my life has become unmanageable. My life was unmanageable. It was overwhelming, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I somehow, some way, as crazy, I mean, I walked in AA, I had two neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other. I had nothing going on for me. And I somehow figured out in my brain something that I couldn't figure out on my best day sober. I figured out that my problem was that I couldn't stop drinking. How do you do that? I don't know how you do that. You can't rob an alcoholic of his last drink. You can't rob an alcoholic of his desperation. And I came in here, looked some guy in the eye, and I said, I can't stop. I said, I can't stop drinking. I came in here, I picked up a white chip, and I haven't had a drink in over 33 years, almost 34 years now. How does that work out, you know? But that didn't happen, you know. And when I realized I had a drinking problem, and I said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. That my drinking problem. Believe me, I had a drinking problem. My life was unmanageable, and I was powerless over alcohol 10 years before that. I just realized it when I was 31 years old. But what I realized after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, then all of a sudden you're in AA for a month or two or three or four. And you realize you can stop the drinking, but you can't stop the thinking. And that's the real problem. You can't stop the what's going on in the brain. And so what happens, I remember I was sponsoring a guy, I think I told this story, named Tommy. And he was, I was three years sober, and I sponsored him. He was one of my drinking buddies. And I went to pick him up. He was one of the top prosecutors in my office, and I think he had a shotgun in his mouth or something. He had to go to court or something. I got him excused from that, and we went over and I picked him up. He had his hair down to here, and he had, he had one pair of jeans and one shirt, and he had been sleeping on the floor of some probation officer. And I picked him up and I took him to his first AA meeting, and he was like home. He took to it like a duck takes the water, and he was like one. It was unbelievable. The next day he shaved, he cut his hair, looked like the old Tommy again. He was like in love with AA. Still sober today. He's got 30 years. Still sober today, and he was loving it. And about 3 months sober, he called me up on the phone, and he was devastated. He sounded depressed. You know, he said, I think I have to leave AA. And I said, what do you mean you have to leave AA? You love AA. You're doing great. It's fantastic. He says, I know. He says, but, and I haven't had a drink in 3 months. He says, but I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I said, what do you mean you don't think you're an alcoholic? He says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. He says, why? He says, Russell, he says, I think I might just be crazy. I said, Tommy, you can be both. I said, thank God, you know, because he had started thinking. He had started that squirrely, crazy deal that goes on in us. You know, Dr. Carl Menninger said in his book about alcohol, Man Against Himself, in the 1930s, he wrote a chapter on alcoholics and alcoholism. He said, alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves because they hate themselves. You give them all the money in the world, you give them anything, somehow they're going to wind up dead with a needle in their arm, or going to wind up dead somewhere, or up against a tree or something. And you see it. You see it in movies, you see it in the TVs, you see it all over the place. You know, that just sort of strange sort of, you see it when you're in the shower, and when you're in your car, when you're driving around, and everything's okay, and then all of a sudden you hear that voice, you know? You're an asshole. You don't deserve to live. Why did you do that? Why are you always screwing up? You know, all those voices, and you turn around to see who's saying that shit to you that's making you feel like a piece of shit. And you turn around and there ain't nobody in the car but you. That's you telling you what you think about you, what you really think about you. And then you try to divert your attention with the radio, with the TV, with the texting, with whatever you can divert your attention, with the shopping, you know, with the spending, doing whatever you can to divert your attention of how crappy you feel about yourself and other people. You know, and it's a tough deal. I suffer from this thing called alcoholism. You know what alcohol, it says the drinking is a symptom of my disease. You know, it's that's the symptom. I said the real disease centers in my mind, not my body. Above everything, I just got to get rid of, you know, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious. Of true happiness, he'll find none at all. And what I found is there's a lot of consequences to being an alcoholic besides the fact that you drink a lot or you can't drink. I mean, I've been to thousands of AA meetings. I've sponsored a lot of people. And you know the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous? Nobody's drinking. You go to New York, you can go to Chicago, you can go to California, you can go to Bali, Indonesia, you can go everywhere. There's groups like this. You want something? Nobody's drinking. They got 10 years, they got 15 years, they got 20 years, they got 30 years. Nobody's drinking. They're saying, my name's so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. They don't, in a sense, they understand that it has something to do with alcohol. And that if you don't maybe treat it, you may start drinking again, because we see it all the time. But people who have been in here for a while know what alcoholism looks like. And I'll tell you something, for most of us, it looks like stuff, it doesn't look like necessarily drinking. It looks like who the fuck they think they are. They can't do that to me. They don't know who they're screwing with. I'll show them. Why is this crap always happening to me? It looks like selfishness. It looks like self-centeredness. It looks like I told my sponsor, I said, I'm sensitive. He says, no, no, Russ, great artists are sensitive. You're just touchy. You know what alcoholism, you want to know what alcoholism looks like? It looks like, well, just look in the mirror. It looks like you. You want to know what an alcoholic feels like? It's the way you feel. You don't know. You don't know that's alcoholism because you think, you know what you think? You think that's just you. You think the way you feel and the way you act and the way you think is just you. You don't think it's alcoholism. You don't think it's like a disease. This is just me. This is the way I always think. This is just me. You know, I'm a blamer. I'm a crybaby. I'm a feel sorry for. I mean, you know, I have a lot of compulsions. I have a compulsion to blame other people. I have a compulsion to feel sorry for myself. You know, I have a compulsion to hate. I have compulsion to want things to go my way. I have a compulsion to be frustrated. I have a compulsion to be angry. You know, I have a compulsion to gossip. I have a compulsion to spend more money than I make. You know, I can't tell you how many things I've bought with money I don't really have to impress people I don't even like. I have a compulsion to feel sorry for myself if I'm not accepted. I'm a compulsion to want to belong. I have a compulsion to hate it when I think some people don't like me. You want to kill an alcoholic? Just go up to him and say, you wouldn't believe what they were saying about you last night. Make believe you're their best friend. Because I have a compulsion, I'm an alcoholic, to befriend people who are going to kill me. I somehow feel comfortable linking up with the worst type of people that are going to drag me down. I like hanging out with people who say, you wouldn't believe what so-and-so said about you. And I call that guy my best friend. He's my worst enemy. You understand what I'm saying? He's got power over me. Because my best friend, a friend, if somebody says something about you at a party, they say, listen, Russell's my friend. And I don't really care what you think about him. If you have a problem with him, you say it to your face. Don't say it to me because he's my friend. And I don't want to hear that horse shit. You understand what I'm saying? That's what a friend does. And then he doesn't tell you about it because he knows it's just going to hurt your feelings. Your enemy comes up to you and tells you shit about what other people are saying about you. You know what I mean? Because he wants to lord over you. He wants to have power over you. He wants to hurt you. Because another compulsion an alcoholic has is talk shit about other people behind their back. I know that because I am an alcoholic. And I know left to my own devices, what I do is I sit in a bar and I drink and I say bad shit about other people. And you, because you're so brilliant, because you recognize assholes, because everybody else is an asshole, because, you know, I see them, they walk in the door, there's the guy, I'm in the bar, I'm with my friend. Guy walks in, he's with a good looking gal. I turned to my friend, I said, look at that asshole. See, that's the most natural thing in the world for me. That's not alcoholism. That's just, you know what that is? That's just me. That's my personality. I said to my sponsor one day, he said, why do you talk like that? Why do you think like that? Why do you say things like that? Why are you angry? I said, listen, that's just my personality. He says, well, Russ, it's your personality that's killing you. Well, what am I going to do about that? How do you get rid of your personality, especially when you sort of like it? You sort of like the crap. What would I be without my personality? Well, I'd be whoever I am without those compulsions. without those crappy self-destructive compulsions, whatever that is, that's who I'd be. That's what I'd look like. I'd look like what they say in the sixth step, who tries to grow in the image and likeness of their creator. The only compulsion my creator has is to love other people. So I was looking at this guy who picked up the 60-day chip, and I was sort of thinking back, because what happens is, I know a lot of you guys are young, so you won't maybe get this, but I'll just try to describe. There used to be a TV show called ABC Wide World of Sports. How many people remember that show? Well, let me try to explain to the people. And they would start off the show. It was a great show. It was about sports and everything like that and all sorts of stuff. And they start out, and this is what the guy would say. The thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. And what would happen is they'd show a guy going down a slalom on a ski. You remember that? On a ski. What do you have? One of those ski things? What do you call those? Okay, ski jump. And the guy's going downhill on a slalom like this, you know what I mean? And he's going like 120 miles per hour, and he looks like a superstar. And he would go, the thrill of victory. And as he would be going great. And then all of a sudden, he would lift off, and he'd start twirling laterally, like a helicopter. And then he'd hit a pine tree. So he'd go, the thrill of victory. Twirl, bam, and the agony of defeat. That's my sobriety for the first 15 years. That's my sobriety. And, you know, I had good sobriety. And I'm not putting down sobriety. I'm not putting down being sober. It must be good. It must be better than drinking because I didn't go back out again. I didn't want to drink. No matter what, I didn't want to drink. But I'll tell you, there ain't no fear like sober fear. There ain't no worry like sober worry. There ain't no sadness. There ain't no self-pity like sober self-pity. I mean, you know, I'll tell you, you know, stuff would happen every, thank God, I don't know how people get do it without a sponsor. Every day I was at my sponsor, you know, something would happen. You know, you're up, you're down, you're up, you're down, you're up, you're down. That's like the first hour, you know what I mean? And, you know, I got him now, I'm king, I'm going to die, you know, I'm rich, I'm poor. I got the greatest boss. I hate this job, you know. You're walking unemployable. 3 months later, you're underpaid and they're screwing you. You know what I mean? And it's like tough being sober. It's like every day there's another freaking clock crisis. When is this going to stop? You know, why me? Why is this? Every day there's something. You're good for like an hour. You know what I mean? You go to a meeting, you watch the Dancing Monkey, you're feeling pretty good. You go out, everything's okay. Then all of a sudden, your bank account is frozen. They cut off the phone. You know, you get a flat tire. Shit happens. It's like unbelievable. It's because the alcoholics, you know, it's like unbelievable. You get a flat tire, you want to kill yourself, you know? That's what happens. You get a flat tire, I feel like killing myself. There's some guy dying of cancer right next to you, you don't even notice him. Look at my fucking flat, man. You know? No, it's true. It's true. If you're an alcoholic, you can be surrounded by people dying, and all you're saying is, look at my flat. What about my flat here, buddy? You know what's going on? It's all about me, me, me. It's a selfishness, self-centeredness. You take all these compulsions that we have that get us in trouble. The compulsion to gossip, the compulsion to do whatever we do that ultimately ends up that we can't. We don't even know they're compulsion because it's just the way we are. It's just me. How do you you got a disease? Yeah, what is it? It's you. What do we have to do? He says, get rid of you. What we got to do is get rid of you because you're killing yourself. Nobody's like, you're killing yourself. It says this. It says right here. It says selfishness and self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. That's the compulsion. The compulsion to somehow be in conflict with everybody and everything and feel sorry for yourself. And somehow in the end, it all turns out crap. No matter how much money you get, no matter what's going on, there's always something wrong. You always got to move to Ohio or Chicago or California, no matter what's going on, because it's crappy over here. It's good for a few moments. You get a little relief, you know what I mean? Sin is good, but only for a season, you know? You can't get laid out of this thing. You can't sponsor yourself out of this thing. You can't find a person to help you out of this thing. there ain't anything material on the planet Earth that you can suck in and put on yourself that makes you okay right here, right now, forever. It's good for about 10, 15 minutes. Maybe you can go to a movie. Maybe you can go to a rock concert. You can do something. You can go out to dinner. You can run around the planet Earth trying to get your American Express card. You can get the new job. You can get everything. But the bottom line is, in the end, it's all horse shit. It's all drinking, drugging, running around, pushing, shoving to get whatever you can in your life to make you feel okay. And one day you call up your sponsor and say, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I think I'm just crazy. Because you don't even know what's wrong with you. Because you can't even figure it out. One day you run into somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous and they don't seem to have that shit going on. They seem to have found that rocket ship in the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. They apparently were painstaking because they have that new freedom and that new happiness. You know what I mean? They lose fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. They lose fear of people and of economic insecurity. You know, they seem to somehow negotiate their way through life, and you know, they just seem to do it, you know, in such a way. And they say they're alcoholics. How can they be alcoholics? How can you be an alcoholic? I don't understand. How can you be an alcoholic? I used to look at these guys. They get up there and speak. You know, seemingly, you know, it's like they weren't worried about other people thinking about it. I mean, I couldn't, you know, they'd ask me this, and I'd say, I'm not ready. I.e., you know, that's alcohol code for I'm scared shitless. What if I screw up? And these guys would do this stuff and negotiate life and go through stuff. I'd see these guys, they were dying of cancer and they were happy and trying to help other people. How do you do that? I got a hangnail. It's good for 5 meetings, you know? These guys are going through chemotherapy and they're sponsoring people. I don't know how to do that. Do you know how to do that? I don't know how to do that. How do you do that? How do you do that deal? It says, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, we step on the toes of others, they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later put in as decisions based on self. I don't make decisions based upon self. None of my decisions are based on self. I just want to pick whatever is best for me. That's all. I just want whatever's best for me, you know? Is that selfish? To want what's best for you, is that selfish? No matter what? Yeah. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all-powerful. They're talking about God, by the way. That chapter, the agnostic thing. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. We became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. I want you to listen to that. What happens is you become less and less interested in yourself or your little plans and designs. Can you imagine that? You became less and less interested in yourself. How do you do that? You can't stop thinking about yourself. You know? Me, 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 me. Hey, enough about me. What about you? What do you think about me? You know? Me, 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 me. That's what it says. It says, established on such a footing, on that footing, we became less and less interested in our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. That's what we feel. You know, as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were be reborn. I mean, what's that? Lose fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter? I remember the first time I experienced serenity. It bothered me. I went to my sponsor and I said, there's something wrong. He said, what? I said, I don't know. I feel funny. He said, what? Do you low on money? He says, no, I'm okay. Is there something? No, work is okay. He says, did something happen? No, everything's okay. Did you get a good night? I said, yeah. You going to? Yeah. I said, I just feel very strange. He says, Russell, that's serenity. Don't worry. You'll get used to it. I mean, because I'm a guy. If I don't have anything to worry about, I'm looking for something to worry about. If I don't have anything to worry about, you want to know something? I'm worried that I'm forgetting something. Because something's going to hurt me. Everything's going to be okay. Everything's okay now. But any second, I'm going to be slapped down because I am a worthless piece of shit. You know what I mean? Because I don't deserve it. Because things could never go that, because it's too good to be true. You know, if an alcoholic, it's too good to be true. It's too good. It's never, you know, if it's bad, it must be true. Because part of my compulsion is the way I think. Not being able to accept good things, not being able to do that deal. So my wife says to me, so what does this have to do with the eighth step and the ninth step or stuff like that? So I was married to a gal when I was like, I don't know, you're going to have to excuse me on dates and times and things like that. Very nice gal, sweetheart. When I was around 24, 25, after I graduated law school, and very nice gal, and got married, set up on a house on Miami Beach on the Gorse Golf Course. Very nice house. I was working as a DA for the state's attorney's office and hanging out with the homicide cops and doing all the cases and stuff like that, and had a beautiful son, wonderful son. I had what, you know, I had the thing that you're supposed, you know, whatever you're supposed to get. I had the house, I had the car, I had the wife, I had the son, I had the job, I had the degree, I had it all, and I was bored. I was an alcoholic. I was restless, I was irritable, I was discontented. I had everything, and you wanted something? Everything was not enough. I knew everything, but that's all I knew. You know what I mean? I didn't know what the most important thing was. You know, I was so flipping brilliant. When I was the smartest guy in the room, I was the drunkest guy in the room. When I argued about everything, I felt crappy. And now, you know, here I am, 65 years old, and I know nothing, except, but I know maybe two or three things. But those two or three things, I really know. And you only need to know a couple of things. All you need to know is one or two things. You probably only need to know one thing, as a matter of fact. There's only one thing that's important. That there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. That's why they probably talk about him all the time. See what your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, that's probably the only thing you really need to know. When you sincerely take that position, all sorts of remarkable things happen. They don't happen just because you're smart. We got a lot of smart people in here. Look what happened. We got a lot of brilliant people in here. We got a lot of sincere people in here. We got a lot of emotional people. We got a lot of people with feelings in here. We got a lot of sensitive people in here. Look how you all turned out. Look at that deal. I guess feelings don't do it. I guess it's something else. So you come in here and you pick up this book. So my wife said to me one day, because I was hanging out in the bar with some friends of mine, guys that really understood me and thought like me. They talked like I talked. They said things like, look at that asshole. They said things like, I can't believe this bullshit. I can't believe what's happening to me. They said things like, they don't know who they're screwing with. They said things like, I'll show them. You know, they talked like me. They acted like me. They thought like me. You know, they were my best friends, my best buddies. They all talked like me. You know, every once in a while I'd run into somebody that didn't talk like me, you know, and I thought they were very uncool and stupid, you know what I mean? So I just hung out with these guys. And one day I came home and I was 5 years sober, and my wife said to me, she said, I just want you to know, if you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you. That's what she said. She said, if you come home drunk more, she gave me a choice. She said, it's either me, your 3-year-old son, your house, and our marriage, or it's the bottle. So I made my choice, and we got divorced. Now, I didn't know that was the choice, but that's what happened. I didn't realize until 5.5 years later. I thought we were just growing in different directions. She didn't understand me. We got married too young. I thought all that stuff, because when you're an alcoholic, you're a rationalizer. I would rationalize. I tell myself rational lies. I tell myself bullshit that makes me feel okay and allows me to do the crap I want to do no matter who I'm hurting, and I excuse myself for it. You understand what I'm saying? Because it makes logical sense, because if you're an alcoholic, especially if you're smart, you can figure out how to fuck everybody, and you're right. You understand what I'm saying? You just can figure that shit out, you know? That's how you just drive people crazy. You go up to people, that's how you get people in Al-Anon, you know? You just, because the way you think. You come up to somebody in Al-Anon when he's codependent, and you give him this bag of crap, you know what I mean? This tangled bag of crap. I'm sleeping with a gal, and she's got a 6-year-old son, and I love him, and she's a heroin addict. She tried to stab me the other day, and I don't know what to do. I'm trying to stay sober, and you're you know, the gal, she says, well, I think you ought to move out. And he says, I can't do that. That's what you're an alcoholic. You say, I can't do that. So then they figure out another way to fix you, and they say, I can't do that. Then they figure out a third way to do that. He says, well, try this. He says, I can't do that. And by the fourth time you say to them, I can't do that, they got to go to Al-Anon because they're nuts. You've driven them nuts. You've driven them crazy. They can't figure out why you can't do all that sort of stuff. But you figured it out. So I left that son. I left that kid. I left my wife. you know, to become the Hugh Hefner of Miami. Now, that was my plan of action. And you actually have not ever heard of me, because the plan, because of a bunch of bad breaks and misunderstandings, the plan never actually worked out well. First of all, you know, to really get a gal interested, you got to be able to stand on your feet, apparently. You can't keep on falling down, you know, and that kind of stuff, you know? So, sure, you guys are laughing, you don't know what it's like. But in any event, but then again, then I got sober. 3.5 years, I didn't even realize alcohol was the problem. I was driving my car with my sponsor. I was 6 months sober, and he started telling me about his divorce. You know, and all our divorces are sort of like the same. It's like, you know, it's me or the booze, you know, you choose the booze, and you know, that's it. And he says, that's what happened to me. I thought we were going in different directions or whatever it is. Let me tell you something. She said, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I came home drunk, she left me. Now, she tried, she was a decent gal, and she believed in marriage, and she believed in the sanctity of marriage. She believed that when you gave your word, you stay, you have a son, you stay there, you have integrity. And I believed in doing whatever the hell I wanted to do to make myself feel good, no matter what. And I wanted to get out of that thing. We went to marriage counseling. She said, let's go to marriage counseling, try to patch this thing up, and we got a son, you got it, and so we went to marriage counseling. The marriage counselor asked her, the standard marriage counselor question, what is it about Russell that you would like to change? That you would like him to do different? And she listed the 3 or 4 things, you know, like, you know, maybe come home for dinner once in a while, you know, not drink, you know, whatever the heck it was, whatever 3 or 4 things were. And I could tell sitting there that I was being dragged. I mean, I had been at the bars. I had been looking at the gals. I had been doing the stuff. I was looking at the new freedom and the new happiness. I mean, I'll tell you, I was looking at those gals. I wanted what they had. I was willing to go to any length to get it. You know what I mean? And I saw her. She was over there with my son. I saw her. She was like dragging me back. This guy was dragging. I felt like Al Pacino, the Godfather. I got out and they dragged me back in. They were dragging me back in. You know, and so he said, well, Russ, what do you want to change about Ronnie? And I said, I just want to go out with other women. And that was the end of that session. We never came back again. That was it. But I'm not an evil guy. I'm a nice guy. You know, I always thought of myself as a nice guy. You know? I was an asshole. You know who does shit like that? Bums do shit like that. People without integrity do shit like that. People that don't give a flying whatever about other people, that's the way they do things. That's the way we act. Irresponsible, godless people do things like that to hurt people. That's what they do. And that's what I was. No matter how many times I told myself I was a good guy, there was a little voice inside of me every once in a while would say, you're an asshole, you're a jerk, you don't deserve to live. Because deep down inside, nobody knows what a jerk I am more than me. Because apparently, the good news is I have a constitutional ability to be honest with myself, and that's what's called the conscience. And man, that conscience will get you out there no matter how many cars you buy, no matter how many gals you go out with, no matter how many jobs you have. Let me tell you, that conscience will always make that karma come back and grab you by the who's-its and destroy you. Because he knows what the deal is. And so I got sober, I got married, remarried, had 3 daughters. And beautiful girls. I've raised them all sober and everything like that. And my first wife got remarried to a really nice guy, super guy, you know, and non-alcoholic, you know, thank God, and raised my son. And when my son, and you know, I did the right thing. You know, I paid child support, put him through college, you know. I'd show up on visitation days every once in a while, you know what I mean? You know, because I'm an alcoholic, you know, somebody, you know, I was a good, you know. And one day, he was 18 years old. I don't know, it's 18, 19, 17, whatever it is. And I was something like 7 or 8 years sober or something like that. I don't know how the time was, but I had been sober for a while, sponsoring people, going to meetings, doing the deal. And he wrote me a letter. And in the letter, he wrote me like a 2-page letter explaining to me how he didn't consider me his father. Explaining to me how he was going to change his name to his stepfather's name. Explaining to me about how I never really cared about him, he never felt like I really cared. Explained to me all this stuff. And my wife got a hold of the letter. My second wife got a hold of the letter. And my daughters got a hold of the letter, who were his sisters. And he said in the letter, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with you or your family. He said that, and my daughters and my wife got a hold of that letter. And I remember they came up to me. She came up to me. She says, "You, that ungrateful, you know, you put them through college. You know, you paid the child support. You've always tried. You know that." And she was like, you know, my wife was like, she was like on the cheerleading team. Go get them. Go pound them. You know what I mean? You know, you don't deserve that. Who does he think he is? My daughters. Oh, forget about that. Because they loved him, you know, and they felt, you know, and they, you know, they got a hold of, you know, they got that letter. And I remember, you know, them saying all that stuff. And you know something? The truth is, as an alcoholic who suffers from alcoholism, had I been involved in our disease, even if I wasn't drinking had nothing to do with it. Most of the people, I'd love to say I hurt people in life because of alcohol. I'd love to say alcohol, I'm a nice guy, alcohol maybe do it, you know? I wouldn't have done it. Let me tell you something. Most of the people in my life that I hurt them cold stone sober, with decisions I made cold stone sober. When I said in that marriage counselor, I just want to go out with other women in front of my wife. When I said that, I was as sober as a judge, okay? I was as sober as I am right now. Most of the crap that came out of my mouth that hurt people, I was sober. You know what I mean? It had nothing to do with drinking. The only thing drinking did was allow me to get away with my sorry ass self and not blow my brains out and make believe I was okay. That's the only thing drinking did. The only thing drinking did was it helped me to live when I was such a crappy person. That's what drinking did. When the demons came, when the shit came in my mind, when I started thinking bad thoughts about myself, when I started feeling sorry for myself, when I started feeling what a piece of crap I was, what a nothing I was, I just have a couple of drinks. That's what drinking does, you know. That's what the deal is. And I've been going to meetings, I've been doing the deal, and I remember what I thought, though. And you know, as an alcoholic, you know, that's my deal. You know, I should have been there right there with him. Yeah, I'm going to write him back a letter. I'm going to pick up the phone. Who the hell do you think, changing your name? I'm not going to be my only son. No, I'm not going to have an, pick up the phone. What the hell do you think you're doing? I'll sue you, take you to court. I'll get your mother, whatever. I'm an alcoholic. I'm justified. And the only thing I remember saying to myself, because I was working this deal we work, you know, the steps, is I had fucked up. Excuse my language, the F word, but sometimes that's as good as a word that you can find. I had fucked up. I had screwed up. It didn't even matter how he felt. I knew I had screwed the deal. I knew I had hurt him tremendously. I knew I was at fault. I didn't really give a crap about it, you know. And you know what I knew? I knew this. I said the only thing I wanted to do is make sure that no matter what I did, I never hurt this kid again. That the only thing I wanted to make sure of is that he knew that no matter what his decision was, that I loved him, I cared for him, and all I cared about was him. And I don't even know where the hell that came from, because that's not me, you know what I mean? You know how they say, hey, it's not me, you know? And I think I wrote him back a letter and I said, listen, son, I'm behind you, whatever you want to do, I love you. Every chance I could get, I'd tell him I'd love him. Every chance I get, I tell him I was behind him. You know, and he lives in another state, and I keep on just telling him how much I cared about him, how much I loved him, and all that sort of stuff. And now he's like 42 years old. He's very prominent in his career. He's got a wife. He's given me two beautiful grandchildren. And the other day he wrote me an email. He said, Dad, when are you coming up to stay with us? We got a room for you. You know? So I don't know how that happens, but you know what it says? You know what it says in the big book? I'll tell you what it says. It says we stop being concerned with our little plans and designs. We start being concerned with other people. That's what it says. It says that when you get sober and you work these things and you do these steps, automatically what happens is you are relieved from being concerned about me. What about me? My name. And you start being concerned about other people. And magically, you don't even have to think about it. It's inspirational thinking, because if I think about it alcoholically, who the hell does he think he is? I paid that money. I did the thing. I followed the law. But when you don't think about it logically and you think about it magically, What you do is you just write a letter and say, I love you, son. I'm behind you 100%. And at 42 years of age, they're saying to you, we love you. Come on up. We want you to stay with us. You see? If you're an alcoholic and you think of it logically, I've got a beef. If you're a recovered alcoholic and you're focusing on God, you know, 1 John 14 says, you know how you pass from death to life because you love the brothers, because you're filled with love, because you love people. And then what does it say right here? This is what it says. It says after the A step, it says, at the moment, it says this on page 77. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives together, but this is not an end in and of itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. So you may think your job is to stay sober, and being sober is real important. You may think your job is a million other things, but I'll tell you my job, you know, you're in here, you become one of the men, you're part of the royal priesthood. Your job is to help and love other people. That's what the deal is. That's what my job is, to do that deal. I don't know when it was. You know, it's a funny thing about AA. I'm going to just take an extra minute. It's a funny thing about AA. I don't know how many people realize this. You will, you know, just like when I was 31 years old, I realized, it came to me like that I had a drinking problem. You know how that is? All of a sudden, you don't have a drinking problem. You don't have a drinking problem. Anybody comes up to you, say you have a drinking problem, you say, screw you, who the hell do you think you are? And then all of a sudden the day comes and it's like that, you're an alcoholic. Like all of a sudden, like, bam, you switch over and you say, I've got a drinking problem. You know, and what happens in this deal? And I don't even know when this happened, because it's a God thing. Because I don't remember whether I was 20 years sober or 21 years sober or 23 years sober or 25 years sober, where I realized that one day I was going to meetings not because I needed a meeting. You know, you ever say this? I need a meeting. I need a meeting. Like, you know, I used to say I needed a meeting like I needed a drink. I need a drink. You know, I need a meeting. And one day I realized that I wasn't saying I need a meeting. I wasn't going to meetings because I needed a meeting or anything like that. And believe me, I'll always need meetings and be congregating with people. But I realized that I was going to meetings. My compulsion or my desire to go to meetings was because there might be somebody there I could help. Do you know how non-alcoholic? You know what that is? That's what happens to you. That's the psychic change, where the emotions and the ideas are shifted over to one side. You become dominated by a whole new state of, you know, where all of a sudden I found myself being concerned with other people, worrying about other people, wanting to see whether I could help other people. You know what's funny? I go to more meetings now at 33 years. I hang around with more guys, I sponsor more people. I'm more involved in this deal, either here or in my church or with other people, probably 10 times more than I ever did during my first 20 years of sobriety. You can figure that out. And you know something? All the guys who sponsored me and all my mentors were the same way. Bill Wilson was the same way. Dr. Bob was the same way. You know, because that's the psychic change. That's what happens. You go from being self-involved and thinking about yourself to being concerned about other people. Some guy came up to me right before the meeting, because I was at a meeting last night up in Boca, and tomorrow night will be another one, and this one, and this one. You know, every day I'm at different things doing stuff. And he says, man, you know, he says, you do a lot of stuff. I said, where else would I be? Where else would I, you know, Bill Wilson said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. And that's what Bill Wilson said. Johnny Harris, I remember when Johnny H. came down from California, and I asked him for his number because I thought it was, you know, he was a circus speaker, and I thought it was unlisted. He said, can I have your number? He says, I'm in the book. I said, you're in the book. He said, Russell, he says, I don't know what fellowship you're in, but I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm available. I'm always available. You know, there are some people that come in here and they get sober and then they're gone. You know what I mean? They said to Bill Wilson, what do you think of somebody that doesn't drink and doesn't go to meetings? He says, I have no use for them. They have no gratitude. They have no love for other people. They still got the selfishness. They're sober. They don't want what we have. They want what they had. They want to get back what they had. You know, and here we all have our choice. We all have our shot. You've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. You don't have that problem where you can't stop drinking. You got your choice now. You can go backwards, you can go forwards. You can use this in order to get back what you had and the same life you had. You just won't be drinking. You'll see how that works. Or you can use this to propel yourself forward. Have a whole different deal going on. In the way you treat people, the way you think about people. And I'm going to tell you this, and I'm going to leave you with this. When you start loving people, when you start caring about people, even the crazies, maybe especially the crazies, you know what I mean? You know? You'd be surprised how incredible life can be. You would be shocked as shit how incredible life can be when you start loving other people. Thank you very much. God bless. Thank you.